Hello, and welcome to Plot Trysts. This is Meg. Today's episode is part of our limited series, My Word is Vorkosigan. These episodes deviate a bit from our regular Plot Trysts format. I'm not hosting them with Lane, but rather with historical romance author and fellow Lois McMaster Bujold superfan Alexandra Vasti. Instead of short, digestible book reviews, these episodes are longer discussions of each book in the Vorkosigan Saga series, and do involve major spoilers. If you're reading along with us, please feel free to join our Discord discussion. You can find an invitation link at our website, plottrysts.wordpress.com, or at the link in our Instagram bio, at plottrysts. Today's episode features Ethan of Athos. We don't have a guest host today, so you can enjoy my and Alex's commentary on what I consider to be one of Bujold's most speculative novels. If you've been listening since the beginning of My Word is Vorkosigan, you might be interested to know that this was our very first episode that we recorded. Hello, and welcome to a special edition of Plot Trysts. We're here again with the next episode in My Word is Vorkosigan, this special series read-along that I, Meg, am doing with Alexandra Vasti. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
And today we're going to be talking about Ethan of Athos. So pretty excited about this one, actually. This is one that I remember very fondly. And so when I got to reread it for this special edition, I was very excited. You know, Alex felt a little bit differently.
Yes, this is one that I remember not as fondly. And in fact, I said that to you. I was like, oh, Ethan of Athos. And you're like, no, it's really good. So I think that I went into it with fresh eyes and had, you know, I guess I knew what I was getting in for. I think that when I first read it, like read them all, you know, in the chronological, like the within series chronological order, I was like, why are we like off out of Miles' world, out of Vorkosiverse a little bit? This time I knew that that's what I was getting into. I wasn't like waiting for Miles to turn up every page. And I think that definitely helped my reading experience.
When you read it the first time, like you read it in like strict chronological order you read this one right after Warrior's Apprentice or?
I think so. I think that that's where it falls in the original. According to the Wikipedia page, which is what I used for my initial chronological order, this one comes after Seed of Ganda. So I would have listened to Seed of Ganda and then Ethan of Athos.
I think when I read it the first time, I was going by, so Lois has the suggestion of the chef, right. And she kind of says that you can sprinkle this in anywhere. I was listening with whatever I could get from my library at the time. And so I kind of held off until there was sort of a gap and I couldn't really get it. I did read it relatively early. I think I read it before I read Brothers at Arms. Okay. I don't think it was as big of a shock for me as it was for you.
Right. Yeah, because the other, all the other books starting with Shards of Honor and going through, they're all pretty tightly connected, you know, pretty much follows on, you know, almost to the, other than the gap between Beriar and Warrior's Apprentice, other than that, like they're pretty close together chronologically. Mm-hmm. So then all of a sudden to have this one kind of be out of left field with visiting other characters and even Ellie, you know, we kind of barely know Ellie at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So it did feel kind of random. But I liked it a lot more this time, even though I still have some concerns that I would like to discuss,
That's fair.
All right. So let's start off with our overview. Are you ready for that now?
Absolutely.
So one thing I think is interesting about this one is that this was actually the third one published. And this was Bujold's, her original book deal was a 3-book deal with Shards of Honor, Warrior's Apprentice, and this one. And Joe Walton had described this as, it was like as if she had three, Bujold had three sort of starts to the series, right? Like three potential directions she could go with the Cordelia books, with Miles books, and then this kind of like outside book. And it was almost like this is Walton's idea. It was almost like she was testing out these three potential series entry points. And this is the one that I think doesn't get taken up as much as the others because it does feature these sort of other characters. So basically the premise of this one, we start off with a character who doesn't appear in any of the other books. He's unique to this book, Ethan, Dr. Ethan Urquhart. And he is a sort of a reproductive, like a uterine replicator technologist. And he lives on this planet called Athos, which is a planet that, you know, doesn't really get talked about. Does it get mentioned at all in the rest of the series? Yeah, I don't know. It's pretty,
No, I don't think so. It might be like one-off, rarely,
yeah, one-off, you know? Line, right? But not in any significant way. And Athos, we learn in the opening pages of the book, is a planet that is inhabited entirely by men. It was a colony that started for religious reasons. They have some interesting religious beliefs about women, and they have this all-men colony. And we kind of learn a little bit with Ethan about how they manage reproduction, about how they manage family units. And so basically what we see is that there is sort of an impending problem on Athos, which is that their female ovarian stock is running out. It's slowly, you know, senescing, and they need some new ovaries to produce, you know, cells so that they can grow more babies in their replicators. And so Ethan gets sort of sent off. They're expecting this package that they were, you know, supposed to be full of ovaries from House Barhapudra. House Barhapudra does not send the right package. And so Ethan is very mad, and he's sort of sent off. He's voluntold to go off and acquire some correct ovaries that will actually work and help Athos continue their biological line. So he goes, he enters the big, wide, terrifying world of mixed sexes. he turns up on Klein Station, encounters Ellie Quinn. So Ellie Quinn, we know, you know, we met her in The Warrior's Apprentice. We don't know a ton about her at this point in the series, but he meets Ellie. They sort of briefly meet up. He runs away because he's afraid of women. And he ends up pretty immediately getting abducted by some Cetagandans who are looking for a man named Terrence C. They are, you know, he doesn't know anything about Terrence C, but they kind of interrogate him for a long time, trying to find out if that's true. They eventually decide to kill him, but Ellie saves him, you know, in a lot of chaos and hijinks, as the whole book has a lot of chaos and hijinks. So Ellie and Ethan kind of briefly work together, but Ethan wants to sort of get away. He wants to kind of continue his project of trying to find the ovaries. So he breaks off with Ellie and then is approached by Terrence C himself. We find out that Terrence C is the sole survivor of a Cetagandan project, a genetic engineering project, which is one of the things that Cetagand is known for, their genetic engineering, to create telepaths. So he is a telepath. He had a wife who was killed when they were attempting to escape from Cetaganda. And he has been trying to use her cells to create her offspring. And so that was kind of part of the original package that was supposed to go to Athos and has been sort of diverted in some way. So they kind of end up going from there, trying to figure out like what exactly has happened. Where did these tissue samples go? Terrence is trying to hide from the Cetagandans. They get back involved with Ellie, and they eventually find out through kind of an interesting and really well-constructed plot that this sort of minor character who's been sort of dogging their steps all along and being sort of horrible, this woman on Klein Station, has actually gotten rid of the original tissue cultures. She claims she threw them out because her son had gone to Athos, and she's, you know, harboring this like bitter resentment about the fact that Athos had sort of stolen her baby in her mind. The Cetagandans are defeated, and they end up then at the very end, they end up finding the tissue samples. After all, they are able to then take the tissue samples back to Athos with the interesting sort of wrinkle that these are telepathic genes. And so the telepathic genes that Terrence had are going to go in and be mixed in and be part of the Athos, you know, in the next two or three generations, they're going to have, you know, telepaths on as part of Athos. Ethan asks Ellie, he's sort of come to accept Ellie as a human being. He asks Ellie for some of her genes. She agrees. So there's going to be some telepathic baby Ellies running around Athos. And Terrence also goes with Ethan to Athos as well. And they have like maybe a, we can talk about the ending a little bit more. So that's the basic plot. There's a lot of hijinks. There's sort of a lot of drama. Ellie, you know, is consistently a badass the whole time. And then we have this really interesting sort of side or intertwined plot about the telepaths and about, you know, what's going to happen to their genetic engineered race and their genetic engineered powers.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I really like about this book is that, to me, it feels like Bujold is engaging with this like wider science fiction idea of a single gender planet. This is sort of a staple of sci-fi, like pulp sci-fi, not SF, right? From what, the 1940s, 50s, 60s.
Absolutely.
And it's usually a planet of women and some like intrepid astronauts arrive on the planet, because obviously the astronauts are all men. They arrive on this planet, and the planet of women is like, oh wow, it's a man. This is going to be great. And, you know, he's going to basically become a breeder, right? But it's like paradise for this guy. So that's what I think is really interesting about this one for me. So I like it in the sense that she's engaging with this big science fiction speculative idea, and she's really throwing a different curveball at it, because it's a planet just of men. And like, they, when Ethan goes out into the wider galaxy, he's like really scared of women. So he's been taught his whole life that women are just like terrible, evil creatures. You're not even supposed to look at pictures of women or read anything written by women. So he is a little bit special, because he's a good citizen. He's a scientist. He's been able to read like scientific literature that was written by women.
He's like shocked that as he's reading it, he's like, I couldn't even tell. I couldn't even tell if it was written by a man or woman.
He's like, what?
You know,
blue as mine.
You know, it's interesting to hear, like, as you were talking about this, you know, being a pulp sci-fi trope, the planet of women, and that there aren't a lot of planets of men. But it's funny, because now in 2023, we get a lot of planets of male aliens, right?
Yes.
Full of like, oh, it's like crash, you know, the female captives crash land on the planet with all alien men. And those alien male, you know, male aliens just like gleefully welcome. And it's, you know, it's a paradise for women.
Yeah.
So, but this is not that, as you're saying, you know, it's not like they're wishing they had some women to liven things up. Like, absolutely not.
No, exactly. And I see this book as kind of being a stealth feminist book, because at first you can't really read it that way. Cause again, the planet is all men. Ethan is pretty misogynistic, right?
Yeah.
Not through experience, but because he's learned it. But there are certain moments where, for example, there's this entire moment that I love where Ethan talks about how clone armies are just economically unfeasible. Like, they don't work, because he's like, you have to spend a lot of money raising the kids. And at least like, she's like, so many planets out here are like, oh, we're going to raise clone armies, and they don't take that into consideration. He's like, well, then they're stupid, because they don't realize like how important raising children is. And it always makes me think of those moments where you're like, well, if men had periods, tampons would be free, right? And it's the same thing. If men are the ones raising the children, then it's valorized and it's seen as one of the most important jobs out there. And Ellie's just like, well, out here in the wider galaxy, we call that women's work.
Yeah. Right? And
it's unpaid.
It's unpaid.
Yeah.
It's not respected. Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think that, you know, for me, it works really well as kind of like 80s and 90s feminism.
Yes.
Not like, and I think that for me in reading this one, it doesn't work for me that well reading it in 2023, but it wasn't written in 2023. So I think that, you know, to give it a fair shake and to properly appreciate it, you have to, you know, take it in the lens and in the time and in the moment it was written. And I think that you're right. For me, one of the things that makes it a difficult read is the fact that Ethan fears and hates women, and he is our perspective character. And it's very hard for me to, you know, I don't think the book would work at all if Ethan wasn't such a great character. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's very sweet. He's very kind. He's constantly, you know, sacrificing himself and caring for others. And yet at the same time, you know, he has a dry sense of humor. He is, you know, he has some multiple flashes of brilliance, you know, in the field. He's a wonderful character. And that's the only thing that saves the book for me, because otherwise being in his head while he fears and hates women is uncomfortable and unnerving for me. It's an unsettling read. I don't like that at all, but, you know, thankfully it's balanced out by the fact that he's such a great character.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he has to be such a great character. He mm-hmm. has to be open-minded enough to eventually right. be like, okay, women are people, you know?
Right.
Like, he does go through that journey and realize it.
It's interesting, though, because at the end, you know, he's like, I still don't like women, though.
Yeah. Well, this is a really interesting one for me, too, because so you were saying we have to read it in the time when it was written. I don't think we've mentioned the publication date yet. It's 1986. Oh, we haven't?
Okay, yeah, 1986.
Yeah, so this was published in 1986. Ethan comes from a planet of all men. He is gay, and he's not like this. He doesn't change. That's right. Like, he doesn't meet a woman and all of a sudden be like, oh, wow, what is this amazing creature that I want to have sex with right away? There's a moment in the book, too, that's amazing. He approaches Ellie with a proposition, and his proposition is that she donate one of her ovaries to right. Athos so that he can have children with her. But he doesn't want to marry her or have sex with her or anything like Definitely that. Not. And he goes to her with this proposition, and she's even like, well, that's not what I was expecting you to say.
He's like, I have a slightly shocking request, and you know, it's a proposition that may horrify you.
Yeah. And she's like, so you know that she's expecting him to be like, look, I've never had sex with a woman. I just want to try it out just this one time. Let's see how it is. But like, no, he's like, not even ever interested in that at all.
Not on his radar. I just looked up the quote because it was so funny to me. Like, he calls her breasts her mammary hypertrophy.
Yeah, right.
like the way it's like, so hi, just, it's so funny, right? It's very funny that, like, you know, how very unsexualized the female characters are, but yes. at the same time there is something like a little unnerving about it, the way that it phrases, the way that phrase, you know, depicts a woman, you know, a female bodied character's physiology as like unnatural, like it's hypertrophy, like it's not supposed to grow that way,
right? But this you know, how he was raised and like his entire foundation, right?
Right. You want to talk about sexuality?
Yes, let's talk about that, because so he has, again, Ethan is gay. He comes from a planet that's all men. The question is this like situational homosexuality? Like, he doesn't have another choice. So I don't think that we can call this like a queer normative book or a book that is completely inclusive or anything like that. Like, he's very much a product of the planet that he grew up on. On the other hand, this was published in 1986.
Right.
He is a gay character, a gay main character, who ends up with a gay happily ever after, or possibility of one.
Yeah, I think that I wish that I could go back and read this in 1986, you know, mm-hmm. be in 1986 and think about how, you know, what else it was coming out next to or with, because I do feel like that Bujold is pretty, you know, in these 1980s novels, like pretty flexible and open. I don't want to say radical, but at least surprisingly open-minded about her main character's sexualities. Like, we have Carol, we have Ethan. And I think you're right that, you know, you could potentially read this as like, oh, well, they're only gay because like they have no choice. But they're definitely, we're told like there are characters who aren't gay, right?
Yes.
That there are definitely characters who, you know, just don't have sex with other men because that's not what they want to do. So, you know, I think it's just, I do almost think you could see it as like a queer normative planet, at least, because, you know, there's no social pressure, I think, or seemingly no social pressure to not be gay ever, right? It's just part of the, you know, one perfectly valid and quite common option in their society. And so the book starts with Ethan on Athos, and he does have a partner who was raised as his foster brother, which I find like a little odd.
Well, this is one I wanted to talk about too. I think it's very interesting because I think she does, this is why I call it her most speculative book, because I really think she was like, this is the premise. How would that work?
Right. Yes.
Right. And I do think it works. Like, she was like, okay, well, if there's no genetic component to reproduction, then there's no stigma about incest. So he has a brother, Ethan has a brother who's been his sexual partner for years. Basically, they grew up together. They now live together. Ethan thinks they're in love. He wants to have children with him, but unfortunately, this guy's not. He's not great. Okay.
Yeah. No, he's absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
It's so great. I mean, it's just such a great, brilliant way to introduce us to the characterization of Ethan, because he is so, you know, devoted to this brother partner guy. And he's constantly like trying to see the best in him, trying to, you know, basically the sort of premise is that they both have to have a certain amount of, they're called like social credits, which is kind of like money, in order to be granted a child. Ethan would be the primary parent, and then the other guy would be the designated alternate parent. But this other guy like cannot get enough social credits because he's just like, he's a fuck up. He just like does, you know, with him, he like drunkenly crashes his light flyer into a tree because they're like dive bombing. What is it? Pigeons.
Yeah. I mean, he's awful. He's basically like an even worse version of Ivan.
Yes, he is, because Ivan at least like most of the time means well,
right?
And Janos like does not. Is that right. How they pronounce the audio? Janos.
I don't know. That sounds like it to me.
No, that's how it's spelled anyway. I can't remember how Grover Gardner pronounces it. Anyway, yeah, he doesn't seem to care about anything other than himself and his own wants and his own desires. But Ethan just like consistently and continually like believes in the best in him and thinks that he is, you know, gonna somehow come around to it. And even on, you know, when he goes sort of out planet and he's sort of like constantly like reflecting on how like handsome Terrence is, you know, but he's like, but I'm still faithful to Janos.
Right. Even though this guy's like the worst.
Yeah.
That brings me to something that I think is an interesting choice on Bujold's part. I think she does it very deliberately, is that she gives Ethan a lot of traditionally feminine qualities. Mm. Like Ethan really, really wants to be a parent. Like that's his overarching desire is he wants to have a child. On Athos, if you are a father, you get to grow a beard. And he's like so jealous when he sees other men wearing beards. And he's like, oh, I wish I had a beard because that would mean I have a baby. And
when his stubble starts to grow in, he's like, oh, I need to like depilate so that, like, you know, you so that people think I'm like trying to pretend like I'm a dad when I'm not. It's really charming.
And his job is creating babies,
right? Yeah,
and like being a counselor. And then he's contrasted with Ellie, who has these traditionally masculine characteristics,
right?
Where she's a warrior, like she's the active one, she kind of pulls him along, she's the one who moves the plot in a lot of ways. So I mean, to me, it's pretty obvious that Bujold is trying to engage with this idea of what is traditionally feminine? What is traditionally masculine? What does it mean when we have characters who don't play into these roles? I don't know.
Yeah.
The degree that it succeeds, I think you're right. It depends on like what lens you're reading it from.
Right. Yeah. I think that part of that and part of what makes it, you know, a great example of like 1980s feminism, but maybe not one that we find so compelling today, is that it does really rely on this gender binary, right? Mm-hmm. Like the concept of bait and hermaphrodites like comes up and then it's just like immediately, it's like, well, that would threaten like the whole structure of this book. So we can't even talk about it. Because it does rely so, so strongly on the gender binary, that men are allowed in Athos and women are not, and that Athos is a society of men and women are feared and hated, and there's just not room in the setup of this book for, you know, anything that might not. It very much, I think you're right that it allows us to kind of consider you know, feminine stereotypes and masculine stereotypes, but that's all grounded within people are men and people are women, and that is the that's the universe. That's the logical structure of the book.
Yes. And very much, this is something that I think is a theme throughout the entire series, is this idea that biology, I don't want to say biology is destiny. So it's not destiny, but biology is just very important in general, mm-hmm. right? Like Bujold's entire, I mean, if you want to say like, quote unquote, her innovation in the science fiction world is like the uterine replicator, basically, right? And so it's the idea of like, let's separate reproduction from gender or from sexuality. Right. And she looks at parenting a lot. Like, parenting is just this giant theme throughout almost every single book. And I think you're right that this book is grounded in this, like a binary, very binary division. So, I mean, right. You're not wrong. In other words.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that it is playful and speculative and, you know, interesting and thought provoking within that very strict context, right? It's, I think, you know, in contemporary sci-fi, we see a lot more, you know, setups that are inherently more progressive or are inherently more just like willing to accept, you know, not that strict binary. And so in this book, for me, it almost feels like her imagination couldn't quite grapple with, you know, something that would really play with gender, with notions of gender and sex, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, this was as far as like her imagination was willing to go, which is interesting because, you know, like she had already set up the notion of bait and hermaphrodites, but it wasn't quite, you know, part of the setup or the structure of Ethan of Athos.
Yeah, I think what makes it work in a larger sense in the galaxy is that she does give these different planets and these different places their own cultures and their own ways of grappling with the idea of reproduction and parenting and things like that. I think it works with these two specific settings, with Athos and with Klein Station, because obviously Klein Station is also itself has some issues, right?
Definitely. Yeah. And that just brings me back to what you were saying earlier about like her, you know, she takes the setup and then really plays it out, because I think you're exactly right. That's something that she does so, so well in so many books is, you know, take a premise, but then really, you know, delve into it and think about how would this work? How would this play out? How would, if you, you know, I mean, I just am, I know we're going to talk about this, but just coming back to that moment where he's like trying to familiarize himself with like the notion of women. And so he's a scientist. So he reads the scientific journals. I mean, that it really does seem like if you were totally unfamiliar with the concept of women, like how would you try to conceptualize that as an idea? I also like when he's talking to Ellie and he's like, he has some line about how he's trying to figure out like what women are like. And he's like, so, but maybe you're not like the ideal model. Maybe you are like slightly different from type. He's like, so are these not just like typical female characteristics?
Yeah. And she's like, ah, Ethan, you know?
right.
But I think one of the things that I also really like about this book is the way she makes the space station work.
Right.
Because this is another one where space stations are a staple of science fiction. You know, you go to space stations and they do this, or you stop here on your way to go somewhere else. But this book is primarily set on Klein Station. And there's this entire part of the book where they're trying to dispose of a body. Yeah. And the question is like, how do you do that? And she really is like, oh yeah, how do you do like, this is a hermetic system. Like you can't just throw this body in a lake. You can't just bury this body somewhere because you can't do that here. So what do you do?
Right. Yeah. So
I really like that too.
And this is Ellie's hometown, right? Mm-hmm. This is Ellie's specific station. Or, you know, her family lives there. This is where she grew up. And it does shed a lot of light on, I think, what were some kind of like throwaway lines for Ellie, you know, or seemed that way until we get this backstory, right? Where she's like, oh, you dirty, you know, ground suckers, whatever. Yeah. But they do, there is like a huge cultural emphasis on Klein Station, on cleanliness, on, you know, microbiology, bacteria, right? It's like borders on an obsession. And it definitely, you know, Bujold is so great at creating these self-contained cultures. And you could imagine that, you know, all of a sudden how horrifying it would be for someone raised in Klein Station to go to a planet like Barry-R where there's just dirt everywhere. there's no cleaning, you know, hyper-hygienic cleaning.
Yeah,
just absolutely. They would walk around in the dirt with their feet.
Yeah. So anyway, it's fascinating to me because I do think she pays attention to details that other authors might. I mean, either they're not important to the story. Again, I'm not saying that I don't love books that don't tell me how you would dispose of a body on a space station.
Of course.
But it's one of the things I really like about Bujold is that she does consider all of those different things. And I think it's fascinating.
Yeah. So the way that they dispose of the body is pretty incredible. It's just all very, you know, carefully thought through. So the So on Klein Station, they have these tanks of newts, right? So why do they have newts again? I don't remember, like, the why. What did the newts come from?
So the newts are, they like basically help break down waste from, right, basically protein waste, right? So any waste that you get, people mostly eat plant-based things, but there's of course that protein in the galaxy, and the newts are just sort of a part of the sanitation system, basically.
Oh yeah. And okay, I'm looking at the text right now. So they have this algae, they grow, yes, this algae to absorb the carbon dioxide and produce oxygen. It's a very efficient way of doing that. But then they have all this algae, and the newts eat the algae and then reproduce and make more newts.
Yes.
So what do you do if you have tons and tons and tons of newts? You eat them. You turn, right, them into food. Only if that's your major food source, as a Klein stationer, you are maybe really sick of newts, and they're frantically trying to give the newts away all the time. They're like, please, yes, take 100 pounds, take 200 pounds. How many, yes, newts do you want?
Yes, it's a great, I just love it. I love the whole thing.
At first I thought she was going to feed the body to the newts, but no, she's going to take the newts and, you know, remove the precise weight of the body of newts, put the body in so that it weighs the exact same, and then, you know, basically ship it away.
Yes.
And then they have extra of frozen newts that they, yes, have to do.
But I mean, let's be honest, the newts are probably going to eat the body, right?
Well, but they eat algae.
I think that the body is getting into the food source.
Oh, it definitely is. Oh, for sure. And that's something that they, it's actually like very funny. They're like, we're going to become vegetarians for the next week or two.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, this body is, you know,
is absorbed.
And, yes.
Right. Exactly. Because so much of the food, and that's another thing that I like about Bujold and her world, is that, you know, they talk a lot about, where does the food come from? And, you know, Cordelia is a Baton, and she's like, I'm not going to eat like an animal. She's like, I like my vat raised protein. Thank you. Right. So that's, you know, they have their vat created food, and unfortunately, you know, the body ends up in the vat. And
yeah, I mean, that's, and again, that's the life on the station, right?
Yeah.
So they've,
yeah,
all, they just kind of accept, like, yep, newts, algae, this is life.
They absolutely do. It's like, we really see the whole life and death cycle completely played out.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know. I like
so, it. So I want to talk about Terrence. We haven't really talked about Terrence too much. So basically, Terrence is the product of this Cetagandan genetic engineering project to create a telepath. And we, you know, we know in Cetaganda that that the Cetagandans love their genetic engineering and have put it to many and varied purposes. And in this particular project, they are trying to create telepaths, specifically telepaths that they could control, because Terrence can only read minds when he is given a certain amount of some particular,
I mean, it ends up being, I actually love this. Basically, if he's a little bit tipsy and has some salt, that, like, it's basically, if he has a beer and some like bar peanuts, he becomes telepathic.
Cheese. Yeah. So, right. So he has to have this tyramine, like,
yes,
you know, and so this is part of their way that they think they're going to catch up with him, because if they've sort of set all these alarms, so if anyone buys purified tyramine, they're going to know, like, oh, okay, that, yeah, you know, that must be Terrence. We're going to, you know, descend upon him. So he really does have access to his telepathic powers. But then Ethan and Ellie come up with the clever idea that, oh, we can feed him foods with a high concentration of tyramine, and then he will get his telepathic powers. Basically, this happens because they're trying to get Terrence on their side. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they talk about how the fact that he's never had to trust anyone, why would he ever have to sort of make a leap of faith, because he can always read their minds. So he can't bring himself to trust them until he's able to read their minds and know that they're, you know, that they're not lying, that they're actually not working with the Cetagandans, and they're not out to get him. But they're pretty much just like somewhat bystanders in the situation.
Yeah.
So they get him a bunch of foods that naturally contain high levels of tyramine, which include sherry and port,
yeah,
and burgundy.
It's very fun. It's very, very fun, actually.
It is.
I actually love that scene. It really also gives you this idea of like what's going to happen on Athos in a generation. Like, people are going to be at like frat parties and all of a sudden be able to read other people's minds.
Each other's minds. Yeah. I have often, many times since reading this, thought about the fact that we really don't know about the repercussions of what is going to happen. So basically they, like, Ethan just agrees with Terrence's plan to do this. The notion is that, you know, as one lone telepath, Terrence is always going to be hunted. He's going to be hunted for governments, by governments, to do spy work. You know, there, no one is going to rest until they control Terrence. But if there are lots of them, if there's a whole race of them, a whole planet of them, they won't be this, you know, discriminated against, you know, marginalized minority, which I think that necessarily works. That's certainly Terrence's idea and Ethan goes along with it. But I'm just like, really, so the idea is in the next generation, you know, it won't manifest because
that you need it on, it's a recessive trait, so you need it from both parents.
So two generations on, it will start to manifest, and you know, Ethan's grandchild could be a telepath. But I don't know, it's still only a quarter of the population, and they're gonna be baby. I just feel like people are gonna be like hunting down Grandpa Ethan, and like there's gonna be like trial. I don't know. There's no council to count on pathos, but like
it could be. I mean, I have to say also, I think Bujold also dropped it because she was like, I don't want to have to think about the consequences.
Well, but also we just like chronologically haven't gotten there in the series, right? Like, I mean,
that's fair. It's
gonna have to be like, you know, 60 years or so.
It'll have to be its own. Like,
they have to, you know. And I'm thinking, like, at what age would you know that your child is a telepath? Like, probably not till they're, you know.
Well, like I said, not until they go to this frat party. You know, like, that's the thing. True. You're not going to know when they're kids because they're not going to be eating.
They're not
going to
have all the tyramine. Oh, right. God, you're right. I feel very worried about, like, these children that are going to grow up and suddenly be able to read minds and they're going to think they're going crazy, right? Like, I mean, there's really...
No, I know.
A big dangling plot thread that is like reliant purely on Ethan and Terrence. Like,
it is
either, you know, getting put in prison or, you know, being there, maybe having taken over the government of Athos by that point.
Who knows?
So it's really interesting. It's interesting to me that Ethan just goes along with Terrence's plan.
I mean, I think there are several reasons I think why, right? I think he's infatuated by Terrence.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
And he's like, yeah, he should be able to have babies. You know, like, everyone wants a baby. Of course he wants a baby. It's interesting to me because I really do think Ethan is like, oh yeah, obviously I understand this motivation. Like, of course he wants to have his own offspring. Like, so do I, you know?
You're right.
And again, brings us back to that theme, right?
Right. So Terrence wants to do this because he has this telepathic partner, Janine, who is raised with him in this, you know, creche or whatever they call it at Cetaganda. And they fall in love and they're together and they, because they're both telepaths, they create this escape plan in their minds. But she's killed in the escape plan. And he, you know, like Cordelia, recognizes the value of biological empire. And he's like, I want, you know, Janine wanted to have kids and I want Janine's offspring to come into the world somehow. And you're right. Ethan does totally sympathize with that. But I don't know. Like, Terrence doesn't seem super happy being a telepath. Like, it's interesting.
He doesn't seem to love it.
He doesn't want to turn off that gene for his offspring. He's like, we will take over the world. that's an interesting alternative approach to being happy as a telepath.
It is. One of the things I thought, I kind of just realized it too, is that Terrence, I think, is able to fit into society on Athos because he was raised in this like weird environment, but also like he fell in love with his sister too, like in quotation marks, right? So
true. I did not think about that, but yeah,
it like just hit me. I was like, wait a minute. So he was like, yeah, sure, this sounds normal, totally,
yeah,
so sure and cool.
And he grows up in this kind of very isolated way, the way that, not that, you know, Ethan is isolated on Athos, but Athos itself is isolated from the rest of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
One part that I really particularly love just about the book and about Ethan, when he finds out that Terrence is a telepath, and he is like, wow, think of all the uses that could be put to. And Terrence is like, yeah, I know, everybody is about the uses that could be put to. And then the uses that Ethan comes up with are so lovely. He's like, Think about, you know, babies when they are sick and you could read their minds and know what's hurting them, or nonverbal people. You could, you know, you could understand how to help them. And Terrence is like flabbergasted because, you know, the uses that people normally come up with are, you know,
buying kind of and yeah. You right. know, PIs, seeing if someone has an affair, like all those things. But yeah. And I mean, that's the thing too. That's the thing that I just love about all of Buchholz's books, is that her characters are just basically decent people.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I just love it.
Yes. It's just so, she's so good at developing these characterizations, and it's just so lovely and so kind. The way that Ethan comes up with this. So Ethan, so we already sort of talked about this a little bit, that Ethan like is instantly infatuated with Terrence. And the, you know, the Seed of Ganon's even kind of imply that like, this is part of Terrence's genetic engineering, that he is so handsome and so charming that like everyone who sees him like kind of develops mm-hmm. a crush on him. You know, so Ethan is, I don't know if the Seed of Ganon's really mean it, or if it's, they're just kind of trying to sort of sow doubt for Ethan, but Ethan definitely is interested in Terrence. And so when they get back to Athos, Terrence goes with Ethan. There is this kind of like open-ended ending that, you know, that suggests that maybe they're going to romantically get together. I don't know. What did you think about the ending?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I like it because, of course, I always love a happily ever after. You know, like it's just very satisfying. On the other hand, I was like, okay, but Terrence doesn't really have a choice right now. We know Ethan is never going to force him to do anything. On the other hand, if Terrence wants to see his children grow up, he's got to find a co-parent, you know?
Right. Well, so they so that's kind of how it works. So basically Janos, horrible Janos, like they get back and Janos has like run off with mm-hmm. a friend. It left Athos completely. Ethan is like not heartbroken. He's like, oh,
kind of relieved. He's like, oh, no, I don't have to like worry about staying faithful to this jerk.
Yeah. Or like just worry about taking care
or
of
that. Yeah.
So he's a little bit relieved. So he sort of sets aside his idea that Janos was going to be his designated alternate parent, and proposes that idea that of being a designated alternate parent to Terrence. And Terrence is open to it. And like, one of the questions he asks is like, is this like a sexual relationship? Like, I'm open to the idea of being your designated alternate parent, but like, do we have to have sex? And Ethan's like, we could.
Yeah. He's like, I mean, I'm not closing the door on the idea, you know?
Right.
And
right.
Terrence is like, okay, maybe someday, let me think about it.
Like, yeah. That's the end. Then that's the end. It's very interesting. Ethan says DA arrangements can be and are entered into by brothers, cousins, fathers, grandfathers, anyone qualified and willing to act as a parent. Parenthood shared between lovers is just the most common variety. And I have so many feelings about this. One is that it's just beautiful, right? Because I think it is just such a wonderful, almost like utopic vision of parenthood, and about, you know, this idea that like a nuclear family with like a sexually committed couple doesn't have to be the only form of parenting. And, you know, of course we see that in the book, that it's not at all the only form of parenting in the Vorkosaverse, I mean.
Right.
So I love that. I love this idea that there are like socially sanctioned sort of parental relationships that don't have to be someone that you're in a romantic or sexual coupling with. But then he's like, but if you want to,
yeah,
we could. He says, I thought perhaps in time you might grow accustomed to our ways. He says, if you find yourself getting used to the idea, you might let me know.
Just, you know, I'm open.
Oh, if you want to bang. And Terrence says, like, this is the last thing he says. He says, I just might. I just might. It's so interesting. Like, I feel like, I don't know. It's very, like, I think it would be written differently today, you know?
I mean, you're not, yes, I agree with you. I think it would be written differently today. I do think she was like, I can't commit fully to this.
Right.
But she leaves it open. But on a slightly different note, the very end of the book, so the very, very, very end.
Let's talk about, right, so right after this, there's like three more paragraphs after I just might.
And it's basically just Ethan thinking that he loves Athos. He never wants to leave Athos. He's committed to living there. And, you know, he loves being in an all-male world. But he does recognize that, you know, women are essential to humanity.
Yeah.
And his the final line is him like saluting his mother, whoever she was, generations ago. So I think it's a very interesting ending.
It really is. And again, I think it's an ending that relies on a sort of gender and sex binary that, you know, maybe we're not quite so committed to in 2023. But I think you're right. And for this particular way that they conceive of the world, you know, he says every ovarian culture on Athos cast a woman's shadow, unacknowledged, ineradicably there. There is something in these last couple of lines that want to acknowledge the way that women haven't been acknowledged for as part of Athos, that they've been hated and feared and, you know, kind of just pretended that they don't exist. But that, you know, that women do play a role in their society, even in a, you know, hyper, you know, masculinized patriarchal society. It's really interesting. And he thinks about his mother, right? So the very beginning when they're realizing that their ovarian stock is senescing, there's this one particular like culture
donor,
that is,
I guess.
Yeah, donor, right, exactly. That is known for creating really good doctors. And the beginning of the story, this potential father comes in and Ethan has to sort of let him know that his what he had hoped would be, you know, a fetus isn't, you know, growing or whatever correctly. And so Ethan has to sort of deliver this disappointing news of basically like a miscarriage within the uterine replicator. Anyway, it turns out that this particular kind of stock that this man wanted, the donor stock, is the kind that Ethan is made from. And it had always been sort of like referred to in terms of the initials,
yes,
like CJ something. X or two or some sort of sci-fi thing. But then in the end, instead of being CJ, it's Cynthia, right? It's like, it's a woman and it's a person with a name. Mm-hmm. And there is something about this kind of like recognizing that, you know, humanity, as you said, in these last couple lines that I do think is really poignant. If, you know, unsettling in the way that I think the whole book is a little unsettling.
Absolutely. All right. So where does this fit in the Vorkosigan timeline, the Vorkosigan universe? This is the third book that she published. Yep. It falls a little bit further in the chronology if you're reading in chronological, internal chronological order, the way we are. But this book technically is the first mention of Fast Penta with that vocabulary word.
Right, which is obviously a super critical part of the world building. It's also, you know, we get Ellie being in love with Miles, just a lot of backstory for Ellie that I don't think is necessary to understand the later books, but is really compelling and just building out this character of Ellie that, you know, that Miles loves so much.
Yeah. One of the scientific journals that Ethan reads was actually authored by Cordelia's mother. So that's always fun.
Yeah. You just, you know, you see the little Naismith and you're like, oh,
yeah. You're like, oh, could that be someone? And you're like, no, that's Cordelia's mom, you know?
Yep. And Ceta Ganda, we get a vision of what the Ceta Gandans look like. And, you know, this is before she writes Ceta Ganda. So before we get that really big delving into their culture. So she just gives us a kind of little glimpse of this whole other world and other culture that, you know, we'll dive into.
And then they reference House Barraputra as well.
Oh, House Barraputra, who is so bad. And it's like just this little hint of like Barraputra being bad. I mean, it's just so remarkable in these long series how authors do. I have no idea how these authors do this, where they just, do they write like a little throwaway line and then just come back and build it out later?
I really want to know that, especially in these books, because the way she published them, she didn't publish them in order, but they fit together. There are only like a couple of times when you're reading and you're like, well, that seems a little weird.
Very rarely.
And even then she's like, well, you could say it this way. And like, it's not jarring. It's just kind of like, oh, I think she had a different idea. But like everything in Ethan of Athos with the Ceta Gandans, with Ellie, it all fits.
It's absolutely remarkable and amazing. I will say, as an author, I do find that you, when you're writing, you write a lot of little throwaway lines. I mean, just just so much, just to make things feel real. You get, you know, you have references to the past, references to other places, references to other, you know, characters that don't actually appear, but you just throw in a little funny, like, you know, sort of comic line about them. And then it does sort of invite like the building out of those other things. However, how she keeps track of all of these things, I have no idea. Like, I could see the throwaway lines building out into whole other worlds, but no, I don't know how she keeps track of all the stuff. It's absolutely
incredible. Exactly. I totally agree with you.
Like, I want to know, does she have like a murder wall behind her?
No,
like...
that's what I wonder. That's what I wonder, because there are other authors who have very big series and in general, everything fits together, but there are a ton of throwaway lines that never show back up. And right, you're kind of like, oh, did they forget about this? Or I guess they didn't really care about that one. And I feel like any throwaway line in a Bujold book can show back up later.
Yes. Like any and line. It's remarkably consistent. Like, I know you read all the Maiden Lane books. I've read all the Maiden Lane books by Elizabeth Hoyt. And there are so many continuity errors. Characters' names change, yes. Their ages change, their number of siblings change.
Yes. Yes.
And that really does not happen too much in the Marcosaverse. It's pretty remarkable.
No. Like, the worst that can happen, and we'll talk about this in another episode, but the worst that might happen is, like, she uses the same name for someone.
Right, but right. Again, I mean, that's just normal. Like, people.
I was going to say, people have the same name, you know, it's totally normal. So,
in fact, it's probably like very fictionalized that people don't have the same name more often in most books. Like, probably if books were actually based on reality, characters would have the same name way more. And you've rarely encountered that in a book.
Exactly. I totally agree.
All right. So, let's wrap up by talking about the title. This is perhaps not the most like super fascinating of titles, but we've got Ethan of Athos. As our title, what work does that do for us, that title?
Yeah, well, I think if you know what Athos is, that gives you a good idea. So Athos is a Greek island where there's a monastery and only male creatures can live on this island. So like mm-hmm. We're including goats, like there can only be male goats on this island, but it's only, you know, men and then male animals and everything else has to be imported. So if you want cheese, it has to come from somewhere else. So if you know what Athos is, or if you're like, I wonder what Athos is, let me Wikipedia that, mm-hmm. then that gives you a hint.
Right. It's also definitely setting up that this is a book specifically about Ethan. It's Ethan's arc. And in the universe, it's very self-contained. Not a lot of the books do have a character's name in the title. And the ones that do, at least that I can think of off the top of my head, are pretty self-contained. Like Captain Perpetual's Alliance is pretty much its own self-contained story. Obviously with recurring characters, but it's, you know, it's Ivan's unique story. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's part of the work that it's doing as well.
Yeah. And to me also, it is kind of a throwback to those classic science fiction, pulp science fiction books.
Oh, right.
Like whatever it was, you know, John Barons of Mars or yep. whatever. So, oh, so I think right. That adds to.
I love that. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. She's just so good.
That's how we're going to end every episode.
Every episode we're just going to rave about it. But thank you guys for joining us on this Vorkosigan journey. If you're enjoying it, please rate, review, subscribe. And we do have a Discord. You can join us there. If you want to read along with us, you can. And you can always follow us on Instagram. So I'm Meg from Plot Trists. And this is Alexandra Vasti Alexandra Vasti.
At myself.
Yes, it's always easy. So thank you so much.
Bye.